Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day with interesting stories from around the world that help you learn and improve your American English. Today's show is special. We go back into the classroom. Today we have some help for you if you have trouble understanding the way some people say English words and sentences. Bob Doty introduces a special guest who has some great advice. Bob?
For VOA Learning English, this is Everyday Grammar. Today, we have a special guest host. Betty Azar is the most successful writer of grammar textbooks in the world. Generations of English learners will recognize her best-selling book, Understanding and Using English Grammar. The famous Blue Grammar book, now in its fourth edition, is in use at language schools across the world. Today, Ms. Azar will offer some advice on how to hear the sounds of grammar.
English speakers talk too fast. I can't understand what they're saying.
Does that sound familiar? It's a common complaint of English language learners, one I've heard often from my university-level ESL students through the years. Normal contracted speech, especially in everyday conversational usage, can speed by like a bullet train. It can leave learners feeling a little dazed as they try to catch the meaning. For most adult learners, reading is, of course, much easier to understand. When understanding English is just between you and the written page, you can go as slowly as you want. You can go back and read words again, perhaps break down the grammar. You can even leisurely look up the meaning of a word. And at least in writing, there are spaces between words. If only that were true in speaking. If only speakers paused briefly between words, it would be so much easier for learners. Teachers in second language classes often speak slowly and distinctly, as I am doing now. But in the real world, well, it's not going to happen. Or, to say that in normal contracted speech, well, it's not going to happen. Speakers squeeze sounds together, or drop sounds, or say them so softly and quickly that a listener can barely hear them. When you listen to my sentence again, notice that the T is almost completely dropped from its, and going to becomes gonna. Well, it's not gonna happen. As a teacher, I've often heard students say things like, "Bye, I leaving now, I see you tomorrow." What's missing? The grammar sounds are missing. In this case, the M and L sounds for am and will. Listen for them in the corrected sentences. Bye. I'm leaving now. I'll see you tomorrow. The M and L sounds are barely said aloud, but a native speaker hears them, do you? Listen again. Bye. I'm leaving now. I'll see you tomorrow. And then, sometimes, native speakers drop not only sounds, but complete words. Listen to this. Bye. Leaving now. See you tomorrow. If you're saying not fair, you're not the first English learner to feel that way. Grammar students learn that am is are and helping verbs, for example, will, have, would, are often contracted with pronouns in both speaking and writing, as in I'm and I'll. But most students also find it helpful to know that in everyday spoken English, these verbs are usually contracted with nouns and question words, too. Here's a sentence about a man named Tom. Tom is a noun. In writing, you will see, "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." In speaking, you will hear, "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." Listen for Tom will again. "Don't worry, Tom will be here soon." Here's another example of a contraction with a noun. My book is on the table becomes, "My book's on the table." And another example, this time with are. In writing, you will see, "My books are on the table." In speaking, you will hear, "My books are on the table." The verb sounds are so quick that it's almost impossible to hear them unless you expect to hear them. Listen again. "My book's on the table." "My books are on the table." Question words, such as where, when, why, are similarly contracted in speech. In writing, each word is separate. For example, "Where are the students?" "Where have they gone?" In spoken English, the question word is contracted with the verb. "Where are the students? Where have they gone?" No wonder it's hard for learners to catch these grammar sounds. If you think English speakers talk really fast, you're right, they do. Do and did are also often reduced. Listen for "do you." "Do you know Mrs. Lee?" Did can be a quick D sound when it's combined with a question word. Listen for "where did" and "what did." "Where'd she go?" "What'd she do?" Did is a good example of a function word. A function word gives grammar information. In the sentence, "Did you eat yet?" did tells us that the speaker is talking about the past and is asking a question. In contrast, "eat" is a content word. So are words such as "Tom," "yesterday," "lunch." Content words have specific meanings. Function words are the ones that are the hardest to hear in speech. Content words are usually said more clearly and loudly. Native speakers can hear the softer sounds of function words, but it can be very difficult for second language learners to hear them. Knowing some grammar can help. For example, learners are more likely to hear and to say, "Bye, I'm leaving now, I'll see you later," if they are familiar with the forms and meanings of verb tenses. If learners don't know what grammar sounds they're supposed to hear, chances are they won't hear them. If they don't hear them, chances are they won't include them in their own speaking and writing. In other words, an awareness of grammar can prepare you to understand what you're hearing, and hearing the sounds of grammar can, in turn, help you use English more accurately. I'm Betty Azar.
You are listening to VOA, the Voice of America. We come to you every day from Washington.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Economics Report. China's economy again has made news as the country works to deal with a volatile stock market and slowing exports. Those issues have influenced markets around the world. China's benchmark stock index, the Shanghai Composite Index, has been decreasing since June, when it reached a high of over 5,000 points. As of Wednesday, the index had decreased more than 40%. Stock prices have lost and gained value sharply. Financial markets around the world have shown increased volatility in recent weeks, in part influenced by events in China. Indexes for stock exchanges in Japan, Hong Kong, and South Korea have all shown volatility. And share prices in major European indexes in Britain, Germany, and France have decreased in the last month. China has taken several steps to try to put a halt to slipping share prices. The government made billions of dollars in loans available to banks and money market funds. In July, stock exchanges halted trading of 1,400 listed stocks in an effort to stop prices from falling. On Tuesday, China's central bank again moved to make borrowing easier in an effort to support the economy and stop sharp decreases in the country's stock markets. The bank reduced a main interest rate by 0.25% to 4.6%. China also reduced the amount of money banks must hold in reserve, giving banks more money to lend. The People's Bank of China also provided more than $23 billion in short-term loans to increase money available to banks and investors. Earlier this month, Chinese officials devalued the country's currency, the yuan. Within 2 days, the yuan lost more than 3% in value. That reversed years of slow increases in the exchange rate of China's currency. The devaluation came on growing evidence that China's economy is slowing. In early August, China reported that its exports dropped by 8.3% in July compared to the year before. That was more than expected and added to concerns about China's economy. Slowing growth in China, the world's second biggest economy, is not unexpected. Kevin O'Leary of O'Shares Investment says growth predictions for China may have to change.
Instead of thinking about China growing at 8%, some think it's going to grow 5 or 6%. That's 20% less growth than anticipated.
Economist Nicholas Lardy is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He is a leading expert on China's economy.
I think the main reason China matters so much is it's the second biggest economy in the world. It's the second largest trading economy.
And that's the Economics Report. I'm Mario Ritter.
From VOA Learning English, welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we continue the story of Alexander Hamilton. He was the nation's first Secretary of the Treasury. Alexander Hamilton firmly believed that no country could become a modern nation without industry. So he carefully developed a program that would make the United States an industrial nation. Part of his program protected American manufacturers from foreign competition.
Hamilton protected them by establishing a system of import taxes on some foreign goods brought into American ports. These tariffs raised the prices of those goods. As a result, American manufacturers had much less competition in selling their products. Alexander Hamilton also organized the nation's finances. One of his first steps was to pay back the debt the country owed from the Revolutionary War. But Hamilton wanted to go much further. He wanted to establish a national bank. Hamilton argued that many European countries had national banks. University of Virginia history professor Andrew O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton saw the advantage of Britain's system. It permitted a very small country to go deeply into debt while fighting wars.
The British had essentially been able to project power well beyond their size thanks to a very efficient financial system and system of borrowing.
Hamilton said a national bank in America would increase the flow of money throughout the country. It would help the national government negotiate loans and collect taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says Hamilton believed a centralized bank would also keep the states from competing with each other.
Banks always have the problem is that they're in the money business, and so they're always tempted to lend too much and to speculate too much, and so he wanted a central mechanism to keep them on a short leash.
But Hamilton's plan raised old fears, especially among farmers in the South. Critics argued that a national bank would give too much power to a few rich men in the North. It would take control of state banks on which Southern farmers and small businessmen depended. It would also increase the use of paper money instead of gold and silver. James Madison led the opposition against Hamilton's plan in Congress. Madison said the United States should not put all its wealth in one place. So he proposed a system of many smaller banks in different parts of the country. He also argued that the idea of a central bank was unconstitutional. No one knew more about the American Constitution than James Madison. He was given credit for most of the ideas in it. Everyone respected his explanations of its wording. Madison noted that the Constitution gave Congress a number of powers which were stated. For example, the Constitution gave Congress the power to borrow money. But Congress could borrow money only to repay debts, to defend the country, and to provide for the general good of the people. Madison said permitting Congress to do more than what was in the Constitution was dangerous. Hamilton presented a very different view. His view came to be known as the implied powers doctrine. In other words, the Constitution includes powers without naming them. Business historian John Steele Gordon says this means that Congress can do whatever it needs to do to fulfill its duties unless the Constitution forbids it.
This is an argument that's been going on in the United States now for well over 200 years and probably will go on for another 200 years.
In 1790, Hamilton's view won more congressional support. He got enough votes to approve his proposal to establish a national bank. Still, President George Washington had to sign the bill into law. Washington worried about the possibility that the bill was not constitutional. So he asked three men for advice: Attorney General Edmund Randolph, Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson, and Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton. Randolph had no firm answer. Jefferson agreed with Madison. Creating a national bank violated the Constitution. Hamilton, of course, disagreed. He said the Constitution gave government a number of powers besides those written down. Otherwise, he said, the government could not work. These arguments did not completely answer all of President Washington's questions, but he went ahead and signed the bill to establish a national bank in America. One of its jobs was to maintain the value of the country's currency and to borrow money for the government. The National Bank also increased the flow of capital needed for investment. It fed the country's business and commercial activities, and it collected taxes. Business historian John Steele Gordon says America's financial success in the 1790s showed that Hamilton's plan worked.
It was known as the Hamiltonian miracle.
The National Bank and many of Hamilton's other ideas had another important effect. They created a disagreement that still exists. The disagreement began with Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. The two men were very different. Alexander Hamilton was born in the West Indies to a man and a woman who were not married. However, Hamilton was educated in America, and he gained a place in society by marrying the daughter of a wealthy landowner in New York State. Money and position were important to Hamilton. He believed men of money and position should govern the nation. Thomas Jefferson could have been what Alexander Hamilton wanted to be. Through his mother, he was distantly related to British noblemen, and he liked fine food, wine, books, and music. But Jefferson had great respect for simple farmers and for the men who opened America's western lands to settlement. He believed they, too, had a right to govern the nation. University of Virginia historian Andrew O'Shaughnessy says both Hamilton and Jefferson believed they were defending the ideals of the American Revolution. And, he says, their disagreement revealed their fears. Professor O'Shaughnessy says Hamilton remembered the chaos under the country's first weak government. He was afraid the government would collapse and there would be social anarchy.
John Adams and Alexander Hamilton felt that differences were breaking down too much and that it would lead to a breakdown in authority.
On the other hand, he says, Jefferson and his supporters were afraid that the American Revolution would, like most revolutions, fail. A small elite group would control the country again. In other words, they were afraid of tyranny. It became a battle of two completely different philosophies of government. Those who supported Hamilton became known as the Federalist Party. The Federalists supported a strong national government with a powerful president and courts. In the early 1790s, the Federalists controlled the Congress. They also had great influence over President Washington. Most Federalists lived in the cities of the Northeast. They were the nation's bankers and big businessmen. They were lawyers, doctors, and clergymen. But at the time, the majority of Americans were farmers, laborers, and small businessmen. Many were bitter over government policies that always seemed to help the wealthy. They had no political party to speak for them. These were the people Thomas Jefferson wanted to reach. Jefferson's task was big. Many of these Americans knew little of what was happening outside their local area. Many were not permitted to vote because they did not own property. Jefferson looked at the situation in each state. Almost everywhere, he found local political groups fighting against state laws that helped the rich. These local groups were what Jefferson needed. He worked to bring them together into a national party to oppose the Federalists. The party came to be called the Jeffersonian Republicans, or just the Republicans. It may sound confusing, but today, many of Jefferson's ideas are expressed by the Democratic Party rather than the Republican Party. This is because of changes in parties and party names over the years. In Jefferson and Hamilton's time, says Professor O'Shaughnessy, the idea of organized political parties was new in America.
Today, we would regard the existence of party politics is essential for the functioning of democracy. There needs to be a minority view expressed. Government needs to be held accountable by an opposing party.
But at that time, he says, the people who fought in the American Revolution expected to be united. As a result, the country did not have any laws governing what political parties could or could not do. There were no restrictions on the political activities of government officials. So Hamilton and Jefferson carried on a war of words in their party newspapers. Both parties' newspapers carried unsigned articles attacking the opposition. Many people felt the two cabinet secretaries should be above that kind of public fighting. But Professor O'Shaughnessy says that did not stop them.
The party politics became as bad as at any time in history.
Toward the end of President Washington's first administration, he received a letter from Jefferson. The Secretary of State said he planned to resign. He said he disagreed with most of the administration's domestic and foreign policies. He did not name Hamilton. It was not necessary. Washington knew what he meant. Hamilton was the chief planner of those policies. But Jefferson decided not to resign. In a letter to his daughter, Jefferson said the attacks on him changed a decision which he did not think could possibly be changed. He must remain and fight. So while continuing to serve as Secretary of State, Jefferson began working to get his supporters elected to Congress. He believed that was the only way to fight Hamilton. National elections were set for 1792. That will be our...